differences. For example, the Eastern figure has an almost life-sized depiction of a fox carved in high relief on its right flank so that it appears to be leaping forward from the crook of its elbow. And whereas the belt of the Western pillar is undecorated, other than by its buckle, the belt of the Eastern pillar bears a number of intriguing adornments, including a series of glyphs like the Roman letter C and others like the Roman letter H. As I study them, I reflect that we cannot possibly know what these symbols meant to the people of Göbekli Tepe, from whom we are separated by a vast span of more than 11,000 years. It is far-fetched to imagine that they had any kind of writing, let alone writing in the alphabet we use today. Nonetheless, there's something strangely modern and purposive about the way these pictograms are used and displayed, and it seems to me that they are more than merely decorative. Nothing else like them exists anywhere in the world of Upper Paleolithic art, and the same is true of the animal and bird figures. At this early period, such a combination of megaliths and sophisticated sculptures is utterly unique and unprecedented. I move on to examine the dozen pillars disposed around the edges of enclosure D, which forms more of an ellipse than a strict circle, measuring approximately 20 meters, 65 feet, from west to east, and just over 14 meters, 46 feet, from north to south. The surrounding pillars are generally about half the height of the central pair, and for the most part are not freestanding, but rather are embedded into the enclosure wall. Most, though not all, are T-shaped, and most are richly decorated with images of birds, insects, and animals, as though the cargo of Noah's Ark has been turned to stone. Foxes, gazelles, wild boars, numerous species of birds, including several cranes with serpents at their feet, many more serpents, both individually and in groups, a spider, a wild ass, wild cattle, a lion with its tail curving forward over its spine, and many more. Making the most of our laissez-passer, I take my time, but eventually on the northwestern side of the enclosure, I come to the pillar I particularly want to see. For ease of reference, Schmidt and his colleagues have numbered all the pillars at Göbekli Tepe, and this is pillar number 43. I know from my prior research that it has a large depiction of a scorpion carved in relief on its base. Some have suggested it might be an image of the zodiacal constellation that we call Scorpio today. However, to my great disappointment, the figure is no longer visible. The archaeologists have covered it with rubble to protect it from damage, Schmidt claims. I tell him of my interest in a possible astronomical connection, but he scoffs at this. There are no astronomical figures here. The zodiac constellations were not recognized until Babylonian times, 9,000 years after Göbekli Tepe, and he refuses, point blank, to allow me to clear the heaped-up rubble away. I'm about to get into an argument with him. There is, in fact, excellent evidence that the zodiac was codified long before Göbekli Tepe, when I notice a group of other figures higher up the same pillar that haven't been covered with rubble. These include a prominent depiction of a vulture, with its wing outstretched in the manner of a human arm, and with a solid disc poised over that arm-like wing, as though being upheld or cradled by it. Another human characteristic of the vulture, quite dissimilar to any examples of this bird that I have ever seen in nature, is that it is portrayed with its knees bent forward and with strangely elongated flat feet. A bit like some of the cartoon representations of the penguin character in the old Batman comics. It is, in other words, a therianthrope, from the Greek therion, meaning wild beast, and anthropos, meaning man, a hybrid creature, part human and part vulture. Above it are more of the H-shaped pictograms, arranged in a row between a series of upright and inverted V-shapes. Again, there's a sense of some message, some communication here, that's impossible to interpret. Finally, at the top of the pillar, are depictions of what appear to be three large handbags, rectangular containers at any rate, with curved handles. Separating them, positioned over the front of the handles in each case, are three figures. At the left, a bird with long, human-like legs that mark it out almost certainly as another therianthrope. A quadruped with its tail arched forward over its body, and a salamander. There is something hauntingly familiar about the whole ensemble, and I feel certain that I've seen it or something very like it somewhere before. The only problem is I can't remember where or what. I ask Santa to take detailed photographs of the pillar, and when she's done, Schmidt suggests that we accompany him to a different part of the site, a few hundred meters to the northwest on the other side of the ridge, where he and his team have an active excavation underway. It's just one of the dozens of buried enclosures with large pillars that they've identified with ground-penetrating radar, and the first of these that they're investigating. Paradigms. As we walk, I ask the professor how and when he became involved with Göbekli Tepe. Ironically, given his firm views on the evolution of architecture, it turns out that he got his big break because other archaeologists also had firm views on the same subject. In 1964, a joint team from the University of Chicago and the University of Istanbul visited the area with a specific brief to search out and discover Stone Age sites. However, when they saw the top of a large T-shaped pillar sticking out of the ground and the remains of other broken limestone pillars that had been ploughed up by local farmers lying nearby, they dismissed Göbekli Tepe as irrelevant to their interests and moved on elsewhere. The reason? The American and Turkish team had judged the workmanship on the pillars to be too fine, too advanced, too sophisticated to have been produced by Stone Age hunter-gatherers. In their opinion, despite the presence of worked flints lying alongside the limestone fragments, Göbekli Tepe was nothing more than an abandoned medieval cemetery, and therefore of no prehistoric interest whatsoever. Their loss was to be Schmidt's gain. At the end of the 1980s and the beginning of the 1990s, he had been involved in another project in Turkey, the excavation of an early Neolithic site called Nevali Chori, which was soon to be flooded by the waters of the Ataturk Dam. There, he and a team of archaeologists from the University of Heidelberg discovered and rescued from the advancing floodwaters a number of finely worked T-shaped limestone pillars that were conclusively dated to between 8,000 and 9,000 years of age. Some had arms and hands, carved in relief along their sides. So, says Schmidt, we recognized that this region had something about it that was different from other sites known from this period. Nevali Chori was our first hint of the existence of large-scale limestone sculptures during the transition from hunter-gatherer societies to early village farming communities. A little later, in 1994, Schmidt came across the report of the Turkish-American survey done 30 years earlier and stumbled upon a single paragraph that mentioned the presence of worked flints alongside fragments of limestone pillars lying on the surface at Göbekli Tepe. I was a young archaeologist, he explains. I was looking for my own project, and I immediately realized that there could be something of significance here, perhaps even another site as important as Nevali Chori, which your predecessors had missed because flints and architectural pillars are not normally associated in the minds of archaeologists. I'm hoping he'll get my hint that he too might be missing something at Göbekli Tepe because of the established paradigm, but he seems oblivious and replies, yes, exactly. I glance ahead. For the past few moments, as we've been walking and talking, we've approached a scene of intense activity. I hadn't been aware of it from the four main enclosures because it had been concealed from us by the summit of the ridge. But now we've hiked north over the ridgeline and are making our way down the other side into the new excavation, nominated as Enclosure H, that Schmidt has opened at Göbekli Tepe. Here, five or six German archaeologists are busily at work, some scraping away layers of soil with trowels or pouring buckets of earth and stones through sieves, others directing the efforts of a team of 30 Turkish laborers. The focus is on a large rectangular cavity, perhaps half the size of a football pitch. It's internally subdivided by knee-high walls of earth into a dozen or so smaller segments. From the floor of these, at several points, hulking limestone pillars protrude. Most are T-shaped, but my eye is drawn to one that has a smooth, curved top, marred only by a small broken segment, and upon which is carved a particularly fine figure of a male lion. Like the lions in Enclosure D, its long tail sweeps forward over its spine, But the workmanship of this piece is of a higher order than anything I've seen so far today. That's a very substantial pillar, I say to Schmidt. Can we take a look at it? He agrees, and we pick our way through the excavations until we're just a couple of meters from the lion pillar. It's leaning at an angle against a remnant of the rubble of cobble-sized stones and earth that had clearly filled the entire enclosure before the archaeologists began work here. Right at the edge of this segment of the dig, the head of another pillar can be seen, while in the middle of the segment a deeper trench has been cut to expose what I guess is the top third of the lion pillar. And this trench, too, is lined by the same rubble of cobbles and earth. I ask Schmidt about the rubble. All those cobbles, I say, how did they get there? They don't look like the result of natural sedimentation. They're not, he replies. He's looking, I think, a little smug. They were put there deliberately. Deliberately? Yes, by the makers of Göbekli Tepe. After the megaliths were put in place, and used for a period of unknown duration, every one of the enclosures was deliberately and rapidly buried. For example, enclosure C is the oldest we've found so far. It appears that it was closed, filled in from top to bottom, so that all the pillars were completely covered before D, the next enclosure in the sequence, was made. This practice of deliberate infilling has been a great advantage to archaeology because it effectively sealed each of the enclosures and prevented the intrusion of later organic material, thus allowing us to be absolutely certain about the dating. I'm thinking rapidly as Schmidt talks. The point he makes about dating is interesting for at least three reasons. First, the implication is that at megalithic sites around the world where this sealing process didn't happen, the dates archaeologists have arrived at could be falsely young as a result of the intrusion of later organic materials, which, by the way, is the only kind of material that is subject to carbon dating, because, of course, you can't carbon date inorganic materials like stone. Theoretically, this could mean that famous megalithic sites that were not deliberately buried by their builders, the temples of Malta, for example, or the taulas of Menorca, or the stone circles of Avebury and Stonehenge in England, could turn out to be much older than we're presently taught. Secondly, if the bulk of the dates at Göbekli Tepe are derived from organic materials in the fill, a fact that I'm later able to confirm from Schmidt's published papers, then this tells us only about the age of the fill. The megalithic pillars themselves must be at least that old, but they could be older since they stood in place before being buried for a period of unknown duration. Thirdly, and perhaps most important, why was the site infilled? What could possibly be the motive for going to all this trouble to create a series of spectacular megalithic circles, only to end up deliberately burying them so thoroughly and so efficiently that more than 10,000 years would pass before they were found again? The first thought that comes to my mind is time capsule. That Göbekli Tepe was created to transmit a message of some kind to the future and buried so that its message could be kept intact and hidden for millennia. It's a thought that will return to haunt me many times as I continue my investigation, but another full year will pass before it comes to fruition, as we'll see in later chapters. Meanwhile, when I put the question to Klaus Schmidt, he offers a completely different explanation for the deliberate burial of the circles of pillars. In my opinion, this was their program, he says. They made the enclosures to be buried. Made to be buried? I'm intrigued. I'm waiting for him to say, as a time capsule, but instead he replies, like, for example, the megalithic cemeteries in Western Europe. Huge constructions, and then a mound on top. But then they're for burial of bodies. Is there any evidence of burial of bodies here? We don't have burials yet. We have some fragments of human bones mixed in with animal bones within the filling material, but no burials at the moment. We expect we'll find some soon. So you believe Göbekli Tepe was a necropolis? It still has to be proved, but that's my hypothesis, yes. And those fragments of human bones you found mixed with animal bones in the infill, what do you make of those? Sacrifice? Cannibalism? I don't think so, Schmidt replies. My guess is that those bones are evidence of some special treatment of the human body after death, perhaps deliberate excarnation. Such rites were practiced at a number of other known sites in the region that are of about the same age. For me, the presence of human bones in the filling material strengthens the hypothesis that we will find primary burials somewhere at Göbekli Tepe, burials that were opened after some time for a continuation of very specific rituals performed with the dead. What then, I ask, was the function of the pillars? The T-shaped pillars are certainly anthropomorphic, Smith replies, yet often with animals depicted on them, perhaps telling us stories connected with the T-shaped beings. We can't be sure, of course, but I think they represent divine beings. And even when they're not T-shaped, I point to the lion pillar, like this one, it too has an animal depicted upon it. Schmidt shrugs. We cannot know for sure. Perhaps we will never know. There is so much mystery here. We could excavate for 50 years and still not find all the answers. We're just at the beginning. But even so, you do have some answers, I point out. You clearly have some ideas. This lion pillar, for example, are you at least able to say how old it is? Honestly, we don't know, Schmidt replies. When we excavate beneath it, we will hopefully find some organic material that we can carbon date. But until we do, we can't be sure. But what's your impression from the style? Schmidt shrugs again before conceding, a little begrudgingly. It looks similar to some of the pillars in Enclosure C. Which are the oldest, I say. Yes, so something of that age. And that would be what exactly? Exactly 9600 BC calibrated is the earliest date we have. Radiocarbon years and calendar years drift further and further apart as time goes by, because the amount of the radioactive isotope carbon-14 in the atmosphere, and in all living, organic things, varies from epoch to epoch. Fortunately, scientists have found ways, too complicated to go into at this point, to correct for such fluctuations. The process is called calibration, so when Schmidt says 9600 BC calibrated, he's giving me calendar years. What 9600 BC calibrated means in 2013 when I'm talking to him is therefore 9600 years plus the 2013 years that have elapsed since the time of Christ. In other words, 11,613 years ago. I'm writing this sentence in December 2014, and you might not read it until 2016, by which time that oldest date that Schmidt is referring to will work out at 11,616 years before the present. You get the idea. In other words, put simply, and in round numbers, the oldest parts of Göbekli Tepe to have been excavated so far are a little over 11,600 years old. And despite all the cautions and qualifications he has expressed, what Schmidt is telling me is that in his informed opinion, on stylistic grounds, the lion pillar we are looking at is likely to be at least as old as anything hitherto excavated at Göbekli Tepe. Indeed, although he hasn't said so much, there's very little evidence one way or the other. The possibility has to be considered that it might even be older. After all, he's already admitted that the best work at Göbekli Tepe is the oldest. It's troubling, therefore. Despite the hope he's expressed that further excavation will reveal the small beginnings that we expect but haven't yet found, that this first piece of further excavation has in fact uncovered no such small beginnings. On the contrary, what it has brought to light is a massive, superbly executed megalithic pillar with a lion rampant carved upon it in exquisite high relief that appears, at least on stylistic grounds, to be extremely old. Perhaps, rather than Schmidt's hoped-for small beginnings, further excavations will only uncover more of the same. We know the end, the professor tells me firmly. The youngest layers at Göbekli Tepe date to 8200 BC. That's when the site is abandoned forever, but we don't know the beginning yet. Except that date of 9600 BC, 11600 years ago, that you have from Enclosure C, that's the beginning, at least as far as you've been able to establish it up to now. The beginning of the monumental phase, yes. There's a glint in the professor's eye. And you know, 9600 BC is an important date. It isn't just a number, it's the end of the Ice Age. It's a global phenomenon. So since this goes in parallel, the date Schmidt is putting such emphasis on rings a sudden bell in my mind, relating to other research.